get started on this, maybe as long as Audrey just passed this out, will you take a minute and explain what this is about?
Sure. So IMLS, which is the Institute for Museum and Library Service, which is the national organization that supports libraries and museums, has an annual award, and we are a finalist. So there's like 123,000 libraries and 35,000 museums around the country, and we're one of the top 30. And so through the next month, there will be, IMLS will be highlighting each library, and then they have not given us a date when they'll announce the finalists, or there'll be 10 winners. And so we're very honored to be part of that group.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to the results.
Thank you.
All right, we'll start with our agenda this afternoon. First up, we have the All Hazard Mitigation Plan update. Mr. Jones.
The All Hazard. No hazard left unmitigated. I could come up with many ones.
Good afternoon, everybody. Let me give you a really quick overview and a little bit of background to get out of the way fairly quickly so that we can get into the more of the content of the presentation, which is today with me, Sandy Gosley, the principal planner for ROTD, is going to be here, as well as Katie Mortensen, our hazard mitigation planning specialist, who's been working with me on this project as it's wrapping up. She's going to be leading us, her assignment's done. So it would be good to hear from her today about things. So what is hazard mitigation? As you can imagine, our flood control structure is the big obvious thing that is around us. It's, to me, I think it's a source of pride for this community that it's been able to be done. If you look up in the ceiling, maybe not in this ceiling, but sprinklers, fire protection system, just about in every building, that's a hazard mitigation system. We know that we can get fire. We've got these little discs that can pop down and spread water if there was a fire that was in here. But there's much more to it, and we'll get into that today. First, I wanted to highlight two things, the funding and also where this plan fits with everything else. There are really two types of plans that we deal with, those that are, we do for the community, on behalf of the community, and those that we do for ourselves. So when we did the continuity of operations plan or the COOP plan, that was for ourselves. How are we going to respond or recover from an incident, an event that impacts us? When we're talking about things that we do for the community, community type plans, we've got the emergency operations plan. It's how police, fire, public works, parks, RPU is going to respond in a coordinated way to any type of disaster. A future plan that we may or may not undertake would be a community recovery plan. There's preparedness items that we do here. The POETI stands for planning, organization, equipping, training, and exercising. Those are the elements of preparedness. And then down here in this bottom corner, the all-hazard mitigation plan. It's just something that we do that is more community-focused. What's our community look like? What are the risks and hazards that could impact us? Tornadoes, train derailments, flooding, those sort of things, and more. Plus, there's other elements that go in there. So when we started off with this, we wanted to come up with a collaborative planning process that went all the way through. Now, the first thing that we did was get together with the planning department and say, what do we want to do to make this plan work? And here are the things that I think that we can check off our list that we accomplished. We wanted to expand participation, to reach out to other groups, to be involved, and to make sure that they were aware of other meetings where they could be engaged. This was a process for us to do that. If you think back to, was it almost 3 years ago now that we did our week outreach, a couple new members here, so we did two big things that Sandy will talk about more, but it was outreach to the disabilities community and outreach to the low English proficiency community. We got the chance to address FEMA's whole community initiative because of that. That was why we reached out to those groups. We wanted to develop a co-ed. We really weren't able to get there with this plan. We wanted a living plan, something that was not going to be put on the shelf, but that we would actually use it throughout the time of the plan and take care of things that are going to be identified in the plan. Katie will talk about how we're going to make this a living plan, the action strategies that we put in there. And finally, the term that I use, it's be sincere, but really what we want is we want a plan that has integrity. Integrity is that what we say we're going to do is what we actually do, and that's what we wanted when we first set out with the plan. Is it going to be reflective of the things that we're doing, or are we just putting a bunch of stuff in there to make it actually look good? I think we accomplished sincerity with this plan. At this point, I really want to get it over to Sandy and Katie to really dig into the hazard mitigation.
So as Ken mentioned, one of the big foci of this whole plan was to get into whole community planning. And by that, I'm going to kind of contrast it with how the first all-hazard plan went when we did it for countywide. I worked on that plan. And pretty much that was all expert-driven. You know, we sat in-house, we brainstormed, came up with a plan, got it adopted, away we go. This time, we wanted to make sure that everybody that is impacted, everybody that is responsible for enacting response measures, things like that, that they all had the opportunity to be a part of the planning process. So for example, we had a series of planning teams. The core planning team was basically our staff and Ken. And then the plan development team were primarily those agencies that are responsible in some way for enacting mitigation strategies. So we worked quite a bit with City Public Works, we worked with Public Health, just a variety of those types of organizations, not just at the city level, but also certain state agencies like Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, DNR, the State Department of Health. Then the plan validation team is more a series of community organizations that have a stake in what happens here in the community in the case of some sort of disaster happening, but they're not responsible for carrying out things. But we wanted to make sure that they got some input onto the plan as to what would serve their stakeholders' needs, and then be able to review the plan as well. So those would be groups like our neighbors, the local chapter of the Association for the Blind, Hiawatha Homes, those kinds of groups. And then focused outreach was the fourth component. And as Ken mentioned earlier, if you think back, it's been almost 3 years now that we got involved with two different consulting groups that helped us reach out to the access and functional needs community as well as the low proficiency English speaking community. And our reason for focusing on those two groups is that we felt that if we could address the needs by those who are most vulnerable in our community, we'd be actually addressing the needs of everybody in the community. So we wanted to build these relationships with these groups and hopefully be able to continue to get them involved in future planning efforts. One of the gentlemen, for example, that we met through CEMSIL actually ended up being on our community action group for the comp plan effort. So, you know, we wouldn't have met him if we hadn't gone through this process for the all-hazard plan. So we've got two different reports that are back in the appendix for the plan, but with ECHO Minnesota was the group that helped us with the immigrant communities. We focused in on the Cambodian community, Somali, and the Hispanic Latino groups, and so those are the three major communities in our city. And then we also worked with Inclusion Solutions, which is a group the Chicago area that hooked us up with members of the listed communities you have there. One of the big things that we really tried to focus on and worked well is that we met with these folks in places that they were comfortable. Instead of having them come down here to City Hall and sit, you know, in a chamber or something like that, we went out to some homes, we went to their organization's meeting space and found out from them what are their concerns, what things, in the case of an emergency, what are they afraid of, what do they need our help with. So this is just a quick example of some of the comments that we heard. With the immigrant communities, some of the biggest concerns were not what to do in case of an emergency. They actually trusted that people would help them. But their big fear was, how do I get across to people that I need help? A number of them said, I speak a little English, but I'm so afraid that in a case of an emergency, I'm going to go into a panic and everything's going to just leave my mind. Or I rely on my kids to translate for me, and if they're not around, what am I going to do? As far as the access and functional needs groups, it was more a matter of access. There was a gentleman I spoke with that I just really felt for him. I am one of these storm preparers. Maybe that's why I enjoy working on this plan. But he lives at one of the residential units for disabled folks, and he's quadriplegic. And he said, he was relaying to me his fear that has happened after his caregiver has left for the night. He's stuck in bed, no way of getting out. He lives on the fourth floor, and the tornado sirens go off. And he's like, I can't get to the lowest floor of the structure. What do I do? Other members that we had met with relayed the whole thing about, you know, we appreciate that you want to take care of us, but we want to make sure we have the knowledge base so we can start by taking care of ourselves until you can get to us. So we took a look at risk assessment, and basically we had to evaluate, okay, what things could be facing Rochester. We didn't have total discretion as to what sorts of items we could look at. We do have to cover things that are covered in the state's hazard mitigation plan, and then we also looked at things that have been studied in Ken's thyroid plan. So it's a series of different types of hazards. FEMA only requires us to look at natural disasters, but we wanted a plan for us, not just what FEMA wants, but something that would be really helpful to the city of Rochester. So we opted to add into that technological hazards, such as infrastructure failures, pipeline breaks, things like that. And then man-made hazards, so things like terroristic acts or cyber threats. We sent out surveys to folks that are in the mitigation role here in town and asked them to respond to this laundry list of things to find out what they felt were important and how much risk that that hazard posed to them. For example, one of the things we have to look at, earthquakes. Not a big thing here, but New Madrid Fault's not really all that far, and there have been instances of feeling tremors in this part of the state from that. So after we did the surveys, we got together all of these different department heads and staff members and used these little clicker devices to try and gain consensus on those topics that we were kind of all over the place on. Yielded a lot of really good information, but we were concerned about replicating what we found here. So we used this information to inform this calculated priority risk index. And basically, we took a look at what's the probability that a certain event is going to happen here in Rochester, how severe would that damage be, how much warning time can we give the populace to respond to it, And then duration is the final thing. And it's not the duration of the event, but the duration of the cleanup and response. So using that little formula, we boil everything down to a high, moderate, or low impact. And here you see the laundry list. These are all of the hazards that we're taking a look at. So the biggies here are windstorms. We know it's windy. Weather Channel actually has us listed as the second windiest community in the country. Tornadoes, hail, train derailments, and school and workplace violence were the things that ranked the highest. In between were a lot more of the technological hazards or things that maybe in other parts of the country would be considered a really high priority, such as excessive or prolonged cold. But we're hardy Minnesotans. We know how to deal with that stuff and can do it well. Folks down in the Carolinas may have a very different response to this. And now I'm going to turn this over to Katie, and she's going to talk about how we found what we have here in the community that can deal with these issues.
All right, I'm going to give you a very broad overview of the nuts and bolts of the plan, starting with community capabilities. FEMA breaks it down into four categories. Your planning and regulatory includes things such as your comprehensive land use plans, capital improvements programs, your emergency management, preparedness and response plans, etc. Here we're documenting what we already have in place and what we might need in the future to deal with these hazards. Administrative and technical details are staff resources that we have in the city and technical expertise that we have available to us in-house we will have to outsource. For example, that includes our engineers, planners, GIS specialists, and employees of that nature. Financial capabilities generally pretty self-explanatory. What are our funding sources in the city and what can those funding sources be used for? And education and outreach is designed to capture the things we're already doing as a city in terms of informing the community about the hazards that might affect us. So Severe Weather Awareness Week and Fire Prevention Week are two good examples of things the city is already involved in to increase hazard awareness in our community. Now, because Rochester is also a part of the National Flood Insurance Program, we have to document our compliance with that program. This includes things such as floodplain mapping, floodplain management, and flood insurance details for the city. If you're terribly riveted by these things, you can find them in the plan. And the Safe Growth Audit is designed to reduce vulnerability to threats that might emerge as the city of Rochester grows. It analyzes the impacts of current policies and ordinances and plans on community safety from hazard risks due to growth. In short, what plans and policies do we already have in place to limit or prohibit future city growth in the known hazard areas in this region? So once we completed the risk assessment and got a clear grasp of what capabilities we already have in place, we began to see potential areas for future growth. The goal of this entire plan is to determine where Rochester is vulnerable to natural, man-made, and technological hazards, and then come up with actionable steps to reduce those vulnerabilities. First and foremost, we want this to be a usable document, and we want it to be applicable to the departments that are actually going to be responsible for implementing the actions we identified. So in order to do this, city departments were heavily involved in the development of these mitigation actions. We didn't want to include anything that wasn't going to actually be beneficial to the community, so we ran everything by the people who actually know. Most of the 134 mitigation actions contained in the plan came from the city departments that would be responsible for carrying them out. Some of these projects are really big, really expensive, and more dream-like projects. And others are smaller and rely primarily on staff, department, time, and knowledge. After the actions were crafted, they were sent back to the departments for a cost-benefit review to determine whether they were a low, medium, or high priority. To determine priority, departments were asked questions such as, will the action be effective at protecting lives and property? Are the actions technically feasible and environmentally sound? Will the actions adversely affect one segment of the population? And does the city even have the legal or administrative ability to carry out the actions? The answers to these questions determine the priority ranking. Other questions on the survey help determine the desired time frame for completion and how much a proposed mitigation action might cost. It's really important to note that Rochester is not obligated to complete any of the actions in the plan. But this plan provides a roadmap to reduce risk as funding becomes available and as time allows. And that's why it has 134 actions in it. We were trying to be rather comprehensive in the possible options we have, and we may not be able to afford this big structural project right now, but maybe we can do more education and awareness and help beef up our So your local planning and regulations include things such as open space preservation, stormwater management regulations, zoning, anything that influences the way land and buildings are developed and built. Restructure and infrastructure projects are probably the most commonly recognized forms of mitigation actions. We're talking our dams, levees, our flood control system. Safe rooms like the one at Quarry Hill would fall into this category as well. And it's also the category that most often gets federal grant money. Natural systems protection includes actions that preserve or restore the functions of the natural systems, things such as sediment and erosion control, stream corridor restoration, and watershed management fall into this category. Education and awareness is a very common category, and it's actually one of my favorites because I think it's very important. Strategy includes actions designed to increase hazard awareness in our citizens, elected officials, and property owners, and then to give these officials, property owners, and citizens the knowledge necessary to mitigate those hazards when they fall on their own property. Such actions include outreach projects, real estate disclosure, hazard information centers, and school-age and adult education programs, many of which we currently have in Rochester. And finally, mitigation preparedness and response support. This one's a little unique in the strategy classification because most of the actions that fall under it aren't really mitigation actions at all, but they are more preparedness and response actions. But they do reduce the impacts of hazards by creating a more robust preparedness and response program, and that's why they can be included in this plan. It includes things such as warning systems, response training and exercises, and mutual aid agreements. Our mitigation plan includes actions under each strategy type to diversify our approach and ensure comprehensive hazard reduction. So what you see here is an example of just 5 of the 134 action items. I included one of every strategy type to show the range that they can fall under. As you see, most of these are, well, all of these are ongoing. Other time frame choices would be short term, which is less than 3 years, or long term, which is more than 3 years. Are you finishing up, or is Sandy? All right. I'm going to hand it back to Ken.
Well, so one of the things that we tried to do was to put review in this so that we could weave it throughout. Generally, when you look at the FEMA guidance that comes with this, you start off in the beginning with doing a little bit of public outreach, and then you really don't do any review of the plans until you're at the end. We've been able to weave this sort of thing in and out of we're at the point now where we're reaching the end where we're doing our public information sessions and our public hearings. So let's talk about what we've done and what we're going to do. Here on the calendar, we've already met with the Planning and Zoning Commission. We've also met with CUBE. That was on the 16th. Today we're here presenting to you the Hazard Mitigation Plan. We'll be doing a public hearing with the Planning and Zoning Commission on the 22nd, and then we'll be coming back to you on the agenda on the 17th for a public hearing on this plan. What happens after that, any suggestions, anything that we get from now until then, we'll incorporate into the plan, we'll tie a bow on it, and we'll send it off to the state, who will then take it through a review with FEMA. We don't know what to expect, but we do know that once that is done, they will be giving us some things that they would like to see as changes. And when we when we get some equilibrium with that, when they're satisfied with where we're at, we'll be bringing it back to you for final adoption. It could be 6 months from now. It could be 3 months from now. We don't know what's on their agenda. And we don't know what kind of changes that we think will be done. I wanted to show you the outside of the Quarry Hill shelter. If you haven't seen it, when I saw what the architect did, I was really impressed. This looks like the rest of the building. It was built in it so it could be a multi-purpose room. I went out this winter and I saw them issuing snowshoes and cross-country skis that were in there. We've got windows in this tornado shelter. It's extremely unique. They tell us that they don't know of any other or very few other shelters that have windows in them. This door is also actuated by the voice modulator siren that we put on site. if we activate that, that door opens up and allows people who are in the park to go into that area for shelter. It's also what we think it's going to be used for the majority of the time. It's the severe weather shelter or tornado shelter for Quarry Hill. They were taking everybody down to a basement, but as you can see, one of our things with this is that we want to cover the whole community. This is an area that anybody in a wheelchair, anybody that can't handle the stairs, this is on a ground level, and it's a tornado shelter that everybody can have access to. One of the things that I really wanted to highlight, kind of made this a catch-all, how do all these plans fit together? You're not going to see the emergency operations plan on here because it doesn't really fit with that. But you'll see this emergency management plan, the hazard mitigation plan, fit with this other emergency management plan that might be in future development. It's big. It would be a recovery plan that we would do for the whole community. And it's really built off of the comp plan. Can you imagine a tornado that goes through town? You can take a look at the flood control structures that we did. We are built on a residential area. When you take a look at the 1978 pictures, I wasn't here, but obviously if you grew up here, you know that the town has changed. We have all these beautiful trails that where we acquired property along Bear Creek or the Zumbro River. If we had a tornado that went through, and the comp plan says that we would like to do this in the future, probably the worst thing we could do is rebuild the city exactly as it was. Instead, what we would want to do is rebuild the city as we would imagine it to be in future development. So that's how the comp plan would fit within a recovery plan. And the hazard mitigation plan really informs both of those things. And I just want to take a minute to do a shout out to one agency and a couple of people. This isn't something that I could have tackled on my own. With emergency management, we really needed the planning department. And for the planning department to put that time and effort on it, I think was huge. As soon as we started this, DMC came along. Then we had to do the transit plan, we had to do the comp plan. There were all these things that kind of kept piling on to the work and effort that they did, and they stuck with it, and I think it's really good. Because when we started off, we just said, we don't want to make this some emergency management thing that's going to be over here in the closet that you never see because we don't have a disaster. Instead, we wanted to build something that we could integrate with our other plans so it would be more of a community plan. And then I really just want to highlight the Jeff Ellerbush was really insightful with some of the grant application development. His insights and the sort of things that he proposed were what you see in this plan now. Sandy Gosley has put in a tremendous amount of hours. When I look at just the professionality of this plan and how good it looks, we've taken a look at a lot of hazard mitigation plans in development of this, and I can tell you that the formatting, the layout, the content that we have in there, it really is a very special and very professional plan, thanks to Sandy. And finally, Katie Mortensen, she came on with us as an intern and it became very quickly apparent to me that she had a lot of talents and abilities that went beyond what you would normally give to an intern. Instead, I was able to say, I'd like you to help me out with this and work on a hazard mitigation plan. And then it became, you're doing a great job. Let's give you more responsibility. And to the point now where you should have seen her at a couple of our other public meetings. People were asking really detailed questions, and she was the go-to person that really had the knowledge. So it's really cool to see what she's, how she's grown and what she's been able to do with this. Finally, I just wanted to talk about funding. It was a piece of that was on there. This was funded by a FEMA grant, a hazard mitigation grant. It's a 75-25 grant. We asked for $80,000, which is one of the highest amounts for a plan that the state has allotted. We use $60,000 really for our consultants on the front end. $20,000 was a match. It was in kind that we were able to put in my time, Sandy's time, toward that. And I really think that we've greatly exceeded the $20,000 worth of staff time that we put into it because we've really made it a sincere and lasting plan. So at this time, we'll entertain any questions you might have.
Okay. Ed, you want to start?
Well, Ken, thanks for doing this. We hope we never have to use these things, but just the depth and the big picture thinking that you've incorporated into everybody's input and pulling something together that helps us with this, the outreach, everything that you did, I think is key. And, just impressive that you put this together. It's kind of when we got involved with the city safety position that this is the kind of things we wanted to make sure we had in place. And if I remember 78, there were things that came about that you never thought about and you never ever concerned yourself with until you had to deal with it. So I appreciate this work. I think it's well done, and it certainly helps us to be stronger moving forward. So thank you.
Ken, I wanted to comment. I was actually looking forward to this presentation. Many of us attended the National League of Cities Conference last week, and there were many, many good sessions, and this is an opportunity to talk about one of those. One of the things that, and I notice a lot of what we talk about here are mostly natural or environmental hazards and so forth, and I appreciate all the work you've done. Something you mentioned very briefly on one of your slides, though, and something they talked about at the conference, is mitigation planning for cyber terror, something that is becoming more prevalent nationwide. And they talk about, you might not think about it initially, but if you think a little bit, we are a storehouse of birth, death, marriage records. Those are fundamental pieces of data to commit widespread identity fraud and so forth. But so that's something that may get added to your plate here a little bit, of course, along with our information technology resources. But the good news also is that they talk about grants and assistance that are available through the state CIO. Across multiple states to get help, so you don't have to tackle this on your own or with a blank sheet of paper. And then the other comment I'll make is they sent us a link, and I forwarded that to administration, Mr. Atkins, to all of the presentations, and there's a slide deck in there under the topic of hot topics in IT, and that's where they talk about some of those issues and some of the mitigation strategies. And so we can get that, I can get you that link, particularly that slide deck. And that's not a conversation for today, but it's something that we, I think, need to be cognizant of and address in terms of a more comprehensive, disaster recovery scenario, because they're not all just natural or environmental. Some of these are becoming more prevalent in the cyber world as well. So I don't know if you have any comments on that, but I just wanted to get that out there. And again, I can send you that slide deck so that you get a little more insight into what they were talking about.
I would say we definitely want the slide deck. I do want to point out we do identify cyber incidents as one of our hazards, and I think it's a moderate level hazard. And we have five or six action strategies already in the plan, but there are definitely more, I'm sure, that could be included.
Well, and what I was going to say is what's really key, too, is that when you have stuff like that included in a plan like this, that sets us up for all sorts of different grant funding, because we can say, hey, we've already got a plan for this, and those grant sources look really favorably on that kind of thing.
One of the things that we've learned, being in the field, I suppose, is that you naturally think that financial institutions are the primary target, and they are actually not so much anymore, because they've implemented measures to protect themselves. Primary targets are places like healthcare institutions, actually. They're maybe not as thorough as they need to be yet in terms of protections, the wealth of data there. And then when we think of, as I say, our governmental agencies, it's not uncommon to think, installing some malware that basically holds you hostage and your data, and that could bring us to a screeching halt in terms of the business we're trying to conduct. So it's just something we need to pay attention to, another facet. Mr. Campion.
I concur with a lot of that. The second part there was a talk of a table that, or some sort of list of priority work and some that didn't cost very much money. And when you said it didn't cost very much money, that caught my ear about something that we may want to tackle. But where is it in the plan? Is that the best way to consume it?
You'll see it. It's a table spreadsheet.
Is there some way for you guys to distill it down to, like, here's the top five, these are the ones that we think you should, that make the most sense? Or?
It's hard to prioritize simply because they're split out right now based on hazard. And how do you say windstorm damage is less important than cyber incident damage?
Way easier for you than it is for me. So let me turn it around and say, I'd like to see, like, a top five. Here's the ones that we think represent good ROI for the city to look at. I think those sorts of things at the level we operate at are a lot easier than, I don't know how many pages it looks like, but it looks like it's well over, 30 or 40.
134 actions,
Chapter 5.
Perfect. There's 134 actions. Getting it narrowed down to 5 as your goal instead of mine could be a really good use of time.
And 62 are rated as high priority.
Oh, is that it?
That's it.
Okay.
Well,
so I guess we always appreciate getting the document. I think that it's translating that sometimes to the next step for the council, which is how we prioritize that, how we integrate it into a possible budget action, how we do things like that. That can be really challenging. So rather than maybe start having to debate 62 items, narrowing the field down to 5 or 4, whatever is a reasonable number for you guys, that will help us. There's going to be some in there that are high priority that are probably millions of dollars where that's not really what I'm looking for. What I'm looking for is, are there actionable steps we should be taking today that are dollar amounts that we can manage in today's budget versus pie-in-the-sky stuff that would be great, but maybe not feasible for the immediate future anyway.
Kind of the way that we developed it and thought about it is we looked at and said, what are we doing today, and what do we have plans for the immediate future? We can look at our CIP. And we know that there are things that Richard has put into the CIP that we said, okay, that makes sense. That's a hazard mitigation thing. Let's put that in there.
Okay.
Are there some other things that are beyond that that we haven't really gotten to? We took a look at some of the things that we've done initially with our website and trying to make sure that the public had information about the best place to shelter in a tornado or some other things. And then Katie looked at it and said, okay, how can we add some more depth and breadth to that whole thing? Getting better at our public education. So it's kind of like, it's true that we need to focus on things and not get too, disoriented by the amount of things that we try to do. But we really try to reflect what departments are already in the process of doing.
Awesome.
And I think too, one of the things that came out, I've been attending the county planning meetings as well, because they're also doing their 5-year update. And one of the things that their consultant stressed is that FEMA is really interested in grants for burying power lines. And, and I know that's an issue that's come up to the council numerous times. So that may be the type of thing that you'd want to look at as part of that whole CIP thing and see how we can get that kind of funding.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anyone else? Mr. Ruska?
I just was going to say, I noticed that earthquakes was on there as a low priority, but one thing that I didn't see on there, and this has been educated to the council, is sinkholes. And I know that that's maybe not a huge deal.
It's in there.
Okay, so we've heard our share of
that. There's 134 items. It's in there somewhere. I can't even think of it.
Yeah. Mr. Roger?
Oh, it's just, I received a note on that topic from Barbara Upton yesterday in the mail. So
there you go. Oh. Time for that. She's still
I haven't heard from her for a while. So.
Just keep an eye on her and make sure we've got it.
Thanks. That's good to share. Yeah.
All right. Any other final comments? Otherwise, thank you very much. We look forward to seeing the results here in a few weeks.
Thank you.
Moving on to our second topic, which is the sewer capacity analysis. Mr. Friesen.
I think she's in.
Thank you.
Sure.
Technology here. Well, today I'm going to give you the short version of this. Okay. So I think my report's thicker than Ken's. And it's going to be just as interesting. Today we're going to give you the short version of basically our phase one sanitary sewer hydraulic modeling of the existing system network out there. So I'm going to lead off with some initial comments. Members from our consulting team, Paul Durkin and Angie Coles, will follow up. I want to acknowledge Matt Crawford, who you know is the project manager here. Angie and Paul are going to do kind of the bulk of the presentation of the study, then I'll have some follow-up comments. Before we get started, though, I want to ask you for a favor. Would you all check your calendars for April 10th to see if you would be available at that? Are you going to have a COW meeting? And if you are, will there be enough of you here to vote on the award of bids for the parking garage? We've needed to push back the bid opening date. It's really going to push it if we have to bring that to you on April 3rd. So I ask you to consider the possibility of adjourning the meeting on April 3rd.
Recessing.
And take
it over. Vote at a committee of the whole. Well, just unless
you recess. Yes. Recess the meeting, okay. Then you could vote. Yeah. Here on the
I'll be here.
I'll be here.
I will also be here.
That's about 7.
Okay. Yes. So I don't know if that's going to happen yet, but I can't start that process unless I had your concurrence. So thank you. So back to the topic at hand here. About 15 to 16 months ago, we began the process of evaluating the capacity of the existing sanitary sewer system. You've heard us talk in the past about the condition of the street network. 20 years ago, we did a hydraulic analysis of the trunk sewers, and in essence what we're doing is we're updating that. We're also building a dynamic computer model which will help us accomplish a lot of additional tasks. Today we're going to talk about the model development and the analysis, what the findings were from that. We're going to talk a little bit about the CCOMP plan again, how we're integrating all of our studies in the city with the COMP plan at some point in the process. And then we're going to talk about the next steps. So we currently have over 500,000 lineal feet of trunk sewer. Trunk sewer is designed as a sewer over 12 inches in diameter. So this map shows that. Next slide. Why don't you back up? I'm sorry. The other thing it shows on this map is the full build-out potential for gravity sewer that we could serve in the city of Rochester. That's the potential. So I-90 down here at the bottom, we can go all the way to I-90. In Hadley Valley, for example, we can go considerably further distance than we are today. You can see where the city limits are. In the South Sunborough, the West Sunborough, and King's Run, we can go further. We aren't proposing that, but we are talking about our ultimate capability, and we've been analyzing that, so we'll get into that today with the discussion. So the last comprehensive system-wide review was in 1996. There have been numerous projects constructed during that period of time. Up here on the board, I've got a copy of the map that was part of the 1996 sewer study, and it shows in the yellow highlight the work that we've actually accomplished in the last 20 years, but there's a significant number of projects on here that still are not complete. And those really are reflected as I look over to this map, but those that are on here in a red color. So the ones that are still shown as red versus green on here are the ones that we haven't been able to fund and reconstruct at this point. So we've been working on the plan. We've been provided a lot of money for us over the last 20 years to upsize sewers in anticipation of growth, but there are numerous projects that are still remaining. We now, though, have new technology and software tools available. We'll talk a little bit about this and the ability, again, to create this dynamic model for our sewer collection systems. So, again, we've talked in the past about I&I and the impact it has on sewer capacity, filtration, and inflow. We've looked at the fact that with new development occurring, a lot more dense development anticipated with the comp plan. It will change how we've evaluated our sewer capacities. And there's a matter of prioritization. So just like with streets, do you fix the worst first, or is there a better investment strategy? Do we replace based on the economic gain or benefit? Do we make investments in certain areas of the community because it will have a more significant impact on the number of developable acres that are available? And are we now at a point of looking at more of a growth management strategy as it relates to sewer? I think it's fair to say for the last two decades that we have responded to virtually every single request for sewer service that we've received. You need it, we're going to provide it. And it's been provided through a number of different mechanisms, initially through annexation, then general development plans, and then the sewer utility plan that sends sewer to the city as it continually grew. And again, it's about as we look forward and continue to invest in the infrastructure, what's the right size? One plan I didn't bring was the 1978 plan that was prepared by one of my predecessors that basically anticipated the growth of the community based on 2020. 2020 growth projections for the city. Back in 1978, we estimated the population of the city about 75,000. It estimated, for example, Northwest, that Holy Spirit Church and School wouldn't even be there, that we wouldn't see expanding that far by 2020. And the investments that they were making back in the 70s and 80s were indicative of that growth pattern. Pipes were put in the ground that were sized based on that anticipated growth. We now are in a situation where, and you've heard me say before, if we make the right decision, we may never have to replace a pipe again. Because we've made it the right size, we've looked at the build-out, we've looked at the fact that water consumption and water use is going down in households, that we may never have to replace a pipe because of both the quality of the materials and the technology available in that regard. So again, with that, I'm going to turn it over to, I believe, Paul is going to start, and then I'll come back up and wrap up. All
right. Thanks, Richard. Yeah, my name is Paul Durkee with HDR. Happy to be here today. Please stop me at any time if you have questions or clarifications. So as Richard said, we've been working actually with the city, Public Works and his team for the past 2.5 years in earnest since December of 2015 on this modeling exercise. Richard talked about trying to validate and refine results from 1996, an updated plan. We got new information, obviously a lot of new growth. We're focused on the 12-inch and larger pipes right now, so the large trunk mains within the city. Obviously, you have a whole thousands of feet of additional pipe throughout the city. The trunk system is the place to start. Identifying system capacity issues, as Richard's kind of pointed out, that map in the back and some of the projects that are still yet to be done. There's going to be some obvious areas that come up, but the model also helps identify additional areas. Richard touched on dynamic. What are we talking about when we talk about dynamic model? Well, a lot of analyses that are maybe a little bit less in depth will look at basically a point in time or a maximum. As you would imagine, you know, traffic flow, you see a snapshot of traffic of a busy interstate or highway at rush hour. There's your snapshot of your peak flow. There's a whole lot more going on before and after that you don't see, and that might not be the same time as the peak somewhere else. So a dynamic model is able to see all of that throughout the system and identify where there might be some restrictions in some areas and not in others, and when that occurs, so you can maybe identify, maybe you don't need to upsize a pipe, maybe you can focus on some diversions or some laterals and things like that you might not always pick up in some of the other types of analyses. So this really provides you a robust planning tool for some of those what-if scenarios, like Richard's talking about, full development, not just the next 20 or 30 years. And once you have that foundation set, you can really play around with a lot of different scenarios. It provides you a way to optimize that CIP, not just for what the pipe size is, but when you're going to need it. So the development process, I'm not going to get into a lot of the details and a lot of the weeds, but these are the general steps of putting together a model that is constructed here for you. This is just a map of the overall flow monitor system that you already have in place. You can't have a model without data. The model is only as good as the data you put into it. So you have, first of all, I want to commend you on having a robust flow monitoring system to even be able to produce or construct a model, as we've done. So we first looked at, okay, where are the data gaps? There was going to be some holes in the data that you're collecting. Monitor wasn't on during a certain time or so on and so forth. We looked at that, where we might be able to put fill in some holes with some survey and things that WHPS and Angie's team really helped support with that. Looked at what's the appropriate tool to use for the model. There's a whole suite of things out there. And then your between your GIS and your flow monitoring system, that's what allowed this model really to be developed. So that previous investment that you made was really critical for being able to take this next step. And then you start working through what we call a calibration validation process. So, okay, here's the monitors that are collecting data during all the time. They're running all the time. And now we're trying to construct a model that mimics that so that we can now predict future events. And we try to match that data as best we can. And then we can start looking at the what-ifs, the existing system as it is, the future capacity, and so on. So this is just a little bit more on the data gap analysis that we first started with as identifying. So here's all your network. The colored dots are places where we identified you need to try to fill in some data with some survey, took an inventory. And again, model only as good as the data that you put into it. And really, you had a really robust set of data to begin with. So there wasn't a lot of work that needed to be done there at all. And selected an appropriate model that allows you not just for use right now, but allows you for more complex analyses down the road. This is what we're calling a one-dimensional model. We can do some more two-dimensional surface water things with it as it flows out of pipes. And you can also integrate stormwater into this model in the future of the site. So we wanted to help choose a model that's robust right now, but also flexible for the future needs. These are just a couple of examples of what we're talking about when we say calibrate or validate. So you've got the two lines in each of the graphs, one blue and one red. The blue is what the meter saw, and this is during the September 2010 event. So it's a pretty significant event in the city here in the past 5 or 10 years. And then the red is what the model predicted or showed when we ran that same storm event in the system. And obviously there's going to be some discrepancies and variations, but in general, this matches really well. And that's partly because you have a lot of good information to use and to calibrate against, and because you have meters across the balance of the city. And then you do some adjustments of some parameters, because there's always some engineering judgment that goes into the modeling. No model is perfect, but models like this can be very useful when you've got the data in the background here that you see, so you can see a really good match. It provides confidence in the ability to then go forward in predicting what you need for the future. So this is that same map that Richard pointed to on the back wall, and I think you have a handout there in front of you. So once we set the model foundation and calibrated to some previous events, then we can look at what the existing system capacity looks like. And I'm just going to step back for one moment on what this is sanitary sewer modeling. So there's really two components. There's the dry weather flow, so on a sunny day like today, there's no rainfall. It's really just the sanitary flow in the system. Generally, those are not your capacity limitations of a system, a sanitary system. Generally, the wet weather condition, even though you think, oh, the pipes are pretty tight, they're not. And I know the city's you've done a lot of work in reducing what we call INI, or inflow and infiltration, at all those joints and locations where there are some places where water seeps in, groundwater levels. So it's not just storm events. But those are the two main components. No system is completely tight. But as you do some lining and do some reduction in inflow and infiltration, your system can continue to get there. And obviously, the new parts of your system are not going to have as much of that. So this is driven by the wet weather flows in general, overall. And you can see in certain areas, down on the East Sunbro and the West Sunbro, there's limited capacity for additional future growth. And I know you've got, as Rick, if you refer back to that previous map, I think maybe that's also in front of you, that map of the potential ultimate development in the city goes far beyond where these existing pipes are. So you can tell that there's concerns in certain areas that need to be looked at for the growth. And this is for what we consider a 25-year storm event. Generally, your system has been designed according to a 10-year, and we wanted to look at a 25-year to kind of give it another factor of safety or level of design. Sorry, Doug, not ready. So I want to zoom in on, this is the West Sub Road, and then get on your map, and that same map calls that pink, kind of pink-purplish basin. These red lines, again, are the ones that have limited capacity. Yellow is marginal, and green is okay right now. Again, this is for existing conditions. I just wanted to kind of dive into an example area to kind of give you an idea of what this looks like. So I'll go to the next slide. Kind of zoomed in. The one stretch here of the alignment, and I'm going to take a look at this pipe right here and what that red means. Click one more time, Doug. So this is what we call a profile. So if you take follow the pipe down from upstream to downstream, this is the elevation. So the pipe's flowing down. The blue is the pipe flowing full. The green line is the ground. And then the red line is actually what the water level is as it pops up in manholes. So you can see in certain places, it's getting close to the surface. And that's where we start noting issues and identifying red, you know, red lights go off in terms of, you don't want sanitary flows flowing out of the stream, right? Now, at some point, active gonorrhea event, things are going to happen. But again, we're trying to look at, a 10, 25-year or a 10%, 4% recurrence interval chance of when these things might happen. So this is the type of thing that we can identify really clearly in the model. Then you can start looking at, well, what's causing that? Maybe it's some slopes in the pipe. Maybe it's some a certain pipe that's constricted. And we can start digging into those things. And again, this is existing system. So we've been able to construct a model and get down to a level of detail on the trunk system and kind of verify some of the previous analyses, such as the things that Angie's worked on in WHPS, and she's going to help and confirm some of those same findings that she's going to go over now.
Angie Cole, WHPS. One of the primary reasons for the sewer study as a starting point was to be a tool for planning in the county to give an indication of where certain areas of the city might be more expensive relative to others to develop. And so again, this is the same map you've seen before, the existing city boundaries, and then the ultimate potential servable area in the mass. So how do we do that? First, among the whole city, it has different sanitary sewer sheds. So we've got up in the northwest corner, it's called Northwest Territories, Kings Run, West Sunborough, South Sunborough, East Sunborough, and then Hadley Valley, and then the center, the downtown area. How would we go about picking out which ones were more or less expensive to develop? There's three components to that. The first one is the existing pipe utilization. So just like Paul was showing you, some pipes are showing up over capacity, overused during rain events. Those don't have any extra capacity for development. If more development were to go on those pipes, they would need to be upsized. So that's the first component. The second component is if the pipes are adequately sized, then just maintain them to give them another 50 to 100 year lifespan. So internal lining and maintenance operations. The third one is just outstanding project balances from previous sewer projects to give adequate capacity, just paying down those old balances. So when you factor in those three costs and then divide it by the number of developable acres that improvements in each of those sewer districts would give you, it gives us a relative apples-to-apples number, a planning rate, if you will. And here is the results of that study. The red is the most expensive, yellow medium, green lower, and then Kingsland and Hadley Valley are the lowest, and we'll get into each of these super districts to explain why this turned out the way it did. But overall, Kingsland and Hadley Valley have the existing sanitary sewer infrastructure to support development right now. I know it's just one piece of the overall development picture, but those two areas have the sewer. On the other hand, South Sunborough has the least amount of available sewer, and Northwest Territories is also doesn't have the infrastructure it needs yet, mostly because to develop up there would require a large lift station to be constructed, which doesn't exist yet. So we're going to start going through each of the super districts, and these maps are similar to what Paul was showing you, but for each one, it'll be what does it look like now with today's wet weather events, and then what would it look like if you completed build up to the ultimate gravity bounds, but kept those existing pipes in the ground. So this is South Umbro, but for reference, we've got Highway 52, 14, this is Soldiers Field, this is the mall, Salem Road area. And there's very little capacity remaining in some stretches of the existing sewer are already at or over capacity. So little area, little extra room is in the sewer. And then if we could go to the next slide, please. You can see that if we added any more water, then that stretches get overutilized. So if you were to develop out here, you would need to upsize pipes all along this corridor. Along the corridor is fairly well developed, hardscaped, expensive. Yes.
What do the regional colors mean on this? Is this neighborhood or?
Yeah, great question. These are sewer sub-districts.
Okay.
So basically this dark green area puts sewage into this one, and then this peach area puts sewage into here. Okay. It's just a way to granulate the analysis. Yeah, thank you. So if we roll together all the costs for upsizing, maintenance, and old, outstanding balances, it's about $11.9 million in South Zumbro. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So aside from our first territory, this was the most expensive area because it was so fully developed already. If we that's fine. I was going to say one more thing. Just to the process, if you were to upsize all the pipes here, and that would open up about 1,200 developable acres. And then dividing 11.9 million divided by 1,200 acres gets you a planning rate about $9,000 per developable acre. Okay, so overall, the second to highest in the city. Okay, now I'm ready. Thanks. All right, West Umbro. This is the one that Paul just showed you. So Highway 14, Highway 52, Valley High. Existing conditions. Almost this entire stretch is at capacity. And where is the area that's most open for development in this area? Oh, towards the west, heading towards Byron. Mm-hmm. The problem is, to do that, then every drop that you add has to be upsized all the way along there. So it gets very, very expensive within this basin to provide enough sewer capacity for development out here. A similar calculation, like I said, upsizing all of that stretch of trunk line, $39 million, opening up 5,200 developable acres, yields about $7,500 per acre. Okay. Middle of the road in terms of expenses. East Umbro is a huge area, as you can see on the map. This is 17,000 developable acres, so like 30,000 gross acres. It's enormous, and it actually benefits us to divide it up into multiple areas when thinking about this area. For reference, we've got Silver Lake Pool up here, Cascade, RCTC, Marion Road, Willow Creek, and all the way down to the airport. So almost the entire half east of the city, and the ultimate bounds go nearly out to Chester. In order to develop that much area, much of the existing trunk lines would be overutilized. So the cost to upsize everything to provide service to the entire area would be $89 million. Huge number, right? So if we can divide East Umbro into phases, to really kind of be smart about how to develop this area, you could look at the East Umbro area, which is here, and inner radius and outer radius. Phase one, phase two. Phase one would be just enough to utilize the existing trunk lines, but not overuse them. So like Richard indicated, some of the old trunk lines resized on a 20-year growth horizon that we've already surpassed. And because of water use and I&I, there's still some existing capacity in here. So there is the potential to develop that inner radius here without having to upsize some of the major trunk lines. So like, for example, the 66-inch and the 60 along the Zumbro. Now phase two would be the ultimate bounds. If you really wanted to go push it all the way out, which would require upsizing everything, mm-hmm. that would be a significant investment for each one. But it's possible to divide East Umbro into inner and outer radius, splitting it approximately evenly and a planning rate of about $5,500 per acre.
Let me ask then, the planning rates that you have and these dollar amounts that you have, is that strictly the cost for the trunk sewers? Does that include the local sewers? Does that include capacity at the plant itself, the treatment plant?
Excellent question. Okay, so this is just for the existing trunk sewers. It does not include the local sewers, so anything less than 12 inches in diameter. Which is okay, because if we're talking planning, you know, in one area, it's really the trunk sewers that are going to convey sewage from one area to the next. Mm-hmm. So it's just the trunk sewers. It's just the existing. It doesn't include any extensions.
you know, assuming those will be carried by the developers. This is just cost to the city. And then the wastewater plant is sized for, you know, 200,000 populations. So we did not include any direct costs to the plant upgrades in these numbers. This was just collections of some money.
200,000 in size for currently?
The facility is has the capability, based on size and configuration, of future expansion to serve up to 300,000 people. The plant is constructed, does not have that capacity, doesn't have capacity for 200,000. It's probably about 150.
It is at least 150, okay.
Thank you. So jumping into the next sewer district, this is King's Run, West Circle 55th Street, Highway 52. And by comparison, the existing sewer in King's Run has been sized for the ultimate development. This is, you know, a relatively newer area of development within the city, so it was forward-looking, already sized for ultimate development. And there is no red area. This pink is CIPP, which means cure-to-place pipelining, which is really, there are only a few sections out of this existing trunk line that are clay instead of plastic and might need to be lined to provide another 50 years of service. So the main costs in King's Run are not for upsizing, but it's just outstanding balances from doing this work in the past. And then if you divide that by the number of acres available, we get to a relatively low rate of $1,500 an acre. So King's Run is one of the lowest areas in the city to develop.
But if you look at the map behind you, it's yellow. We've already replaced this line once. And that's why it comes out so good now. Because we've already had to replace it once. And that was the project up there that's highlighted in yellow, which just represents this green line. So again, in the future now, we won't need to replace it because it's been sized properly to serve the ultimate sewer boundary.
So I've heard this a couple of times. Ultimate build out, or full build out, or whatever you guys want to call it. How can we? Is that just based on the comprehensive plan we're developing that this is the destiny for this area? Or are we asserting that there's some maximum density we can build the area to?
It's based on being able to serve an area by gravity sewer. That's so not, all it is.
So not density. Then.
It's not density. It's not urban service area. It's all just based on the sewer shed. That sewage within this particular geographic region would have.
You're getting to a really complicated problem that I'm sure I will struggle to understand in this amount of time. But if we can continually build bigger pipes out here, or are you saying there's some limit to the size of pipe we can put in the ground out here? Because I can foresee a build-out in a dystopian future where we all live in 99-story buildings out here, and that would produce far more waste than the residential subdivision that's out there. So when we say full build-out, are we talking about full R1 build-out, full R4, you know, future dystopian?
We worked with the planning department both in 96 and again recently here to basically use their best guess of a land use plan going forward. I think it's fair to say that most of these areas beyond the current city limits and beyond the city's current urban service area boundary are assumed to be residential and primarily low-density residential.
And my only point is at 300,000 people, right, wherever that is in the future, 100 years from now or whatever it is, we may, you know, the neighborhood I live at that right now is green could be producing a lot more waste if it's replaced with apartment buildings, right? And we're not saying that this is the ultimate future. We're saying that this is the build-out of what we foresee these areas as they are currently developing.
Based on them being able to be served by gravity.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Second to last basin, this is Hadley Valley, and the sewer that's there right now has also been sized for the ultimate development. So the only costs carrying forward there are some balances on this, these trunk lines. So again, relatively low, $3,300 an acre. As Roger pointed out, the costs are only for the existing trunk lines, like city costs. Any future extensions are not included in that. Northwest Territories is a little bit more complex. It's a very large area, basically extending from 18th to 60th Avenue and then all the way up to 100th Street with various phases. So 7,300 gross acres, and of that, this area was included.
include in sizing but not in cost recovery or developable. Likewise with that. So for the purposes of this study area, there was only 2,800 developable acres. The cost to serve this area, because of the terrain, it has to get up over the hill before it can get to the treatment plant, requires the construction of a major lift station and some trunk line improvements, is about almost $40 million. And that results in a significant SAC or sewer availability charge. If you just look at the cost for that area, it would be about $13,000 per developable acre, but once they factored in the downstream capacity improvements necessary as well, it was up to $16,000. So the Northwest Territory was, when all said and done, about twice the cost of any other area from a sewer standpoint to develop. So given that, one of the things Public Works did was look at, is there a way to allow some additional development in this area without having to go full hog and build that lift station? So this is North 75th and 65th Street, Menards, Prairie Crossing development area. And there's two existing lift stations here. And right now, they're just serving this one development. But with some modifications, there's a potential to serve this area hatched in white. So it's about 1,000 gross acres. We assumed about 48% developable, so 480 developable acres. That brings, if you upsize the lift stations to handle that white hatched area, it gets about $7,700 an acre. So it's you know, more in line with the rest of the city for that small portion. And here's the roll-up for the numbers that we've been talking about. So each of the sewer districts, outstanding project balances. As you can see, some of the older areas don't have as much. Some of the newer areas do. Capacity upgrades. Kings Run and Hadley Valley already have the capacity that they need, so there's no dollars listed there. But some of the other basins, it gets to be quite significant. And then condition upgrades, CIPP. These are the pipes that are older, maybe need to be lined to give them an additional 50 years of life. Roll that into the total amount, I think $158 million to expand and maintain the sanitary sewer to serve the ultimate gravity service area. So quite a bit of money, emphasizing the need to really pay attention to where development is occurring, and that's and when the model comes in too, to be smart about it, putting development money in at the right time and the right place. So the existing system modeling outcomes, just like we discussed, identified the sewer capacity, limited truck sewers and areas. This might have been a little bit of a surprising outcome. There are some sections that just simply don't have enough capacity for very much more development. And identified the priority areas. So some of the things that Paul was showing you, those red areas, those really need to be looked at in a little more detail. And develop recommendations for next steps. Basically, where can we put money of the sewer system to get the most bang for the buck for development, you know, opening up the most areas and make it the most sensible. Okay. That's it. Turn it back over to
you. So let me just say that there is no one particular area that is in such a bad condition from a capacity standpoint that any single project we would say no. With the exception, potentially, of Discovery Square. They're talking between 1 million and 2 million square feet. And again, we're talking the local pipes downtown do not have enough capacity. So last week we met with Mortensen and Ivy and the Mayo folks and basically explained that to them. Now we have capacity in the trunk sewers downtown, but this gets now to this tier two level analysis where we start getting into the smaller pipes. So again, there will be circumstances where we're going to have to make some investment. It's not going to be in the trunk sewers as much as it will be in some of the lower pipes. So somebody asked a question earlier about that. So what we did is, in 2015, we did a quick high-level review. The maps that you looked at were kind of that, and that was used in conjunction and shared with the planning staff and their consultants to look again at where we had available sewer capacity, where was the best place for the city to make an investment as it relates to growth. Starting in 2016, now we've done a lot more comprehensive analysis. And as Angie pointed out, here's the table now put into this map that you saw before. So Kings Run and Hadley Valley are in good shape. So those particular areas, we don't have any concerns about development in those areas as it relates to sewer capacity, even under the wet weather circumstances.
But, for example, in the East Sumbro, again, this is the, with full, what I refer to as a full build out. This is what we did back in 2015, the high level analysis, and you can see now what the model is producing. Again, this is part of the calibration, producing a very similar result as it would relate to the lines that are more than 150% capacity. Next. So, what are some of the key outcomes to help support it, the comp plan decision making? We established these super sewer sheds and the SAC planning rates. As I said, the new development in Kings Run and Hadley Valley is the most cost effective from a trunk sewer perspective. You need not make any more investment in your trunk sewers in that area. The estimated time for inflow, infill and new development will be served by existing sewers before they need upgrades, so there are certain areas where we have capacity within the city limits. Infill development utilizes existing pipes, so here there's no extra sewer costs. But in some particular circumstances, like I mentioned in Discovery Square, we're going to need to put in a much larger pipe to serve a million square feet of office space than that where currently there are parking lots. And identify the need for trunk sewer capacity and condition upgrades. Again, we will be able to develop maps now that look at the capability and the need for where we need to make the best investment. I think the phase one, phase two for the East Sumbro was a good example of that. And what the model will allow us to do is allow us to go in and do a pipe-by-pipe segment replacement and basically determine that, okay, if we put that pipe in, we can free up 500 acres. And if we put the next 400 feet of pipe in, maybe 1,000 feet of pipe, we can free up this. And it may not all be linear. It may be a piece here and a piece down here that we'll be able to accomplish that.
When you do such a thing, how will you divvy up who gets access to the newly created capacity? Is it whoever's first and is willing to pay the new SAC fee?
I would anticipate so. I mean, it's going to be based on people coming in with, you know, general development plan or with whatever for development in that area. I think it'll be important for us, though, to let the development community know what's available and where it's available and when it's available. So if it's currently available, we need to let them know. And if it's not available, we need to let them know that also. I don't know if you noticed, you probably didn't notice it, and I probably should have had Angie point it out, but in a lot of the maps that she had up there, you notice the end of the pipes were green. It's because, again, for the last 20 years, we've been putting the right size pipes in. We've been putting in 21-inch pipes that dump into 12-inch pipes because we know that the 21 is what we need, and eventually we'll have a plan to replace the 12, and we have enough capacity in the 12 right now to serve it, but eventually it'll have to be upsized. So what are the next steps? So, part of this process that we've been going through over the past year is to help establish a level of confidence in the city staff that the model is what we want it to be. In other words, so working with Paul and Angie, it's basically using their expertise and their is to develop a model that we have a lot of confidence in. Because if we don't have confidence in it, we're not going to use it. And we've got to that point now that we, with the analysis that we've done in the East Sumbro District, there'll be an item coming to you on April 3rd to basically go to this next level. So the downtown model expansion. So not only include the trunk sewers downtown, but include the sewers less than 12 inches in the downtown, primarily the DMC District. So we have that model developed. So when a developer comes in and wants to plop down 1,000, 100,000, 1 million square feet, or this in this location, we can run that model scenario. But it also can mean that we can run several different scenarios with several different projects. We've got, right now, a half a dozen projects downtown going on. So how do all of those work collectively? So we'll be able to use that model. But what we need to do in the downtown is get all of the pipes in the model. And right now, we only have the larger diameter pipes. We would like then to expand out into the South Sumbro, all of the South Sumbro, all the way out to
Amber Valley School and that area out there. That all flows through downtown.
Mr. Wojcik has a question.
All the sewers southwest flow through downtown.
My bigger question here, just on the downtown part, I don't want to lose this. My assumption is that this is going to be part of DMC funding. I'm doing this study because it's a specific infrastructure project related to DMC.
That hasn't been determined yet.
I think it just was.
Check.
But yep. Actually, it's my understanding Deed makes that decision, not you.
Oh.
So
Ultimately.
Yeah.
Deed makes that decision.
I think Deed will conclude that sewers are infrastructure.
I don't disagree with you, but I'll just say ultimately you will have to go to Deed with that. So we need to look at the south suburb, as we did in the detail in the east suburb, and make sure the flows that we have coming into downtown are updated from 1996, and that they are valuable resources. We look at the tier two analysis for the downtown area. So we want to be able to do that, and so look at both the south suburb and then upsizing the east suburb. Once that's done, to along with East Sunbro, do some CIP planning going forward.
So Richard, let me ask another question then with regards to this. Are we doing any look at possible where the upsizing is taking place and where the road base has run its course? I mean, my assumption is most of the sewer probably goes underneath public roadways.
Most does.
You know, except along the rivers and
yes.
whatnot. But so are we taking an opportunity to look at where we simultaneously need sewer upgrades as well as the road rehabilitation?
Yes, I mean,
okay.
That will all be part of this. So if RPU needs to replace a water main in that right of way, that will help prioritize maybe that section.
A lot of cities formalize a dig once policy, but I don't think we formalize it, but we do that.
We've been doing it for 20 years. So
and maybe you're building up to this climax and everything, but what I'm thinking in the back of my head is we established about a $1.4 billion unfunded liability in streets. What do we see as an unfunded liability currently right now in sewer?
Well, again, the system works fine. The system works
just
great
with the SAP
when it doesn't piece. Rain. When it does rain, we have some surcharging occurring.
Okay.
We have no overflows. We have
okay.
We don't have sewage coming out of any of our manholes. We don't have sewer overflows to the river or anything like that, so we're in good shape in that regard. But we're getting to the point that as more and more development occurs, we really have to be careful. One, about where we locate it, and two, do we have a plan then to help facilitate that? And all of this area that's served by the green pipes, you've made a significant investment in roads and water towers and storm sewers and stormwater management ponds. You made a significant investment, and I think that's what we basically working with the planning staff is, that to continue to extend the sewer beyond the current city limits isn't just the cost of the sewer. It's the cost of all of those other utilities, electric, water, storm sewer, stormwater management, roads. So it's all that additional infrastructure cost. But, you know, eventually that will be needed. Comp plans for a 20-year window. Again, as I look at this, I think we need to be planning as we replace pipes for some ultimate service area and sewer capacity. So the long-term goals here is to finish the development of the sewer model in all of these super sewer districts, looking at future conditions and develop a CIP improvement plan for those areas. Developing the citywide model, enhancements that would include not only the big pipes but also the small pipes. As was mentioned, they do feed in, but because most of the city is developed, there really isn't too much pressure on those systems from a capacity standpoint, but every once in a while there is something that we have to look at, and the dynamicness of this model will allow us to do that and do the life scenarios. And again, just consolidate the district building blocks into the comprehensive sewer master plan. So again, just some listing of some additional model uses here. So a development plan review, that's a robust planning tool of the predictive what-if scenarios, real-time modeling and forecasting. We've been collecting flow information in our sewers for close to 15 years. We've had it stored out on servers, and finally are now able to utilize it, and we're able to pick out some storms that were very reflective of some of the major storm events. Look at forensics and predictive sewer analysis and optimized sewer and treatment plant O&M strategies. So it's not only replacing the pipe, it's the CIPP is basically a lining process where we can go in and effectively reestablish the internal condition of pipes, because usually they fail from the inside out due to corrosion and other things. So that's all we have. Again, like I said, on the 3rd, I'll be bringing forward an RCA that will be asking us to go back, Doug, basically to allow us to do some of this additional work here, kind of as the next logical phase. What we do with this phase is, again, staff wanted to be convinced and have develop a level of confidence in not only the development of the model, but how it works, and then the training that we're going to be receiving to be able to utilize it.
All right. Mr. Campion?
Fabulous work. So I've come to expect fabulous work from Public Works as well as many of our other departments, but specifically with a lot of this long-term planning stuff out of our planning department and Public Works. The one sentiment that I feel like I find myself consistently having is we should just say no to some of these areas. So instead of putting up a number that says it's $16,000 per acre for sewer, it may make sense just to say we're not going to continue development in these areas. This is just completely deprioritized. We're not even willing to make the infrastructure investment. And I'm wondering, there's obviously multiple parts to this, but in areas where we don't have any infrastructure built yet, how do we send a message clear about our priority for development? We have these areas that are ripe. Comprehensive plan, you're going to tell me. I'm setting you up. This is a softball. When we send this message, I want to make sure it's clear and that the council supports, you know, that message. Is areas, there are areas that are developable, there's areas that are not developable, and we expect to develop the areas that are developable.
I'm going to let Mitzi give you the answer here, but let me use an example. If you can go back to the East Umbra. Mm-hmm. So, West Scenic Oaks. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think it's coming through, or you may have already approved it. But it's way down here, and just
48th.
Off of 48th Street Southwest, just west of the reservoir, and it was outside the Archie Urban Service area. I think it was right just across the line, and so they came to us and said, "What are you going to do?" And we had sized all the sewers down in this area appropriately. There's one little piece in the golf course, but they're going to go out and tear up the golf course again this fall to replace a small stretch of 8-inch pipe. But then everything will be good up to, you know, a certain point. So again, we've kind of got this section on the end that's good. Well, again, not any one developer is what tips us over on these. It's many, so it's it the first guy that comes in, it's the first development comes in that we're going to respond to. That's the part of saying yes and no right now, I think, that staff will struggle with, and maybe even the council, is you got three projects competing for the remaining capacity. Which one do you pick? The first one in, and if they don't come at the same time, how do you know? So I think Mitzi had an answer to your question.
Mitzi?
It's going to change the map. So if you take a look at this, the ultimate sewer sheds that can serve the city really take into account a much, much longer growth horizon than we are planning for at this time. That's maybe 125 years or more of growth for this city. We do not need hardly any of that for the next 25 years. Okay? So we can be very strategic and fiscally prudent with the investments we make over this planning horizon to open up those areas that are the most cost-effective and that strategically help us implement the vision of the plan. So if you look at the Kings Run and the Hadley Valley, lighter green areas up here, they're pretty easy to serve. They're areas that have been highly desirable by the development community. They've marketed well. It's an easy area to say continuing growth in those locations. operations makes good sense. What else makes good sense is the prioritization of some infill redevelopment where we have some tired aged corridors and we want to move toward a bus rapid transit system. Mm-hmm. So between those two things, we have enough land area in the city to accommodate our growth.
That is what I was looking for through all of that is I hope that we start on annexation requests, on requests to extend service, that all of the staff can feel comfortable coming back to us and saying, this is too expensive. This is not what we want to do. There's a reason we're driving for in growth, for very edge growth where we've already established infrastructure. So, I mean, it's great to have this to back it up. I'm glad to hear we're studying some of the downtown. We need a policy for how we're going to divvy up additions and when new capacity is released, what's going to happen. I hate the idea of first come, first serve because that rushes everyone to get in the minimalist design project that consumes the amount of capacity they think they'll need. But there's also, you know, how are we going to divvy up paying for some of stuff? And the SAC, those fees all look non-competitive in some ways and competitive in others. So I'm just glad to see it looks like we're going to exit this with a set of fees that we can draw clear guidance from about what it's costing the city to support developments in certain areas.
Again, I don't want to get to the weeds, and I know we're right at our time here, but just think about it from this perspective. If any of you are familiar with this area and know Mr. Hickey is, okay, the density that will occur here will be half of what occurs here. This is a very challenging area. Steep slopes, deep ravines. So we may never even approach, we may get 2 units per acre here if we're lucky, versus 4 units per acre over here in Northwest. So again, right now, the numbers are the same because, it's remaining debt and the cost to make it the pipe big enough. Well, the pipe is already big enough. But yet the density you get here will be half of what you get over here. So there still will be those just kind of decisions you need to make when it comes to that total cost of investment. Right. What is your ROI on that investment? How many units per acre? That sort of thing.
I have several hands. Mr. Mayor, then Mr. Hickey, then Mr. Woodrick.
I'm just wondering, the new Hilton Hotel, is that being impacted by sewer lines to that right next to the Post Bulletin and across?
No, fortunately, the trunk sewers, as you probably will recall, back in 1988, ran down the middle of Broadway.
Yeah.
So what we don't want to ever have to do again is replace those pipes.
Okay.
So what we are looking at right now is a new parallel line. In fact, it's out for bid right now, running on First Avenue. Between the library and the parking garages,
okay.
That will be basically be parallel to Broadway, and then we'll provide some relief to those lines. So, again, it's continue to look at. So, no, to answer your question, the Hilton
House might have a piece of road to shut off again.
Yep.
Okay, Mr. Hickey?
I've got a more general question. How unique is Rochester to have such a large geographical area to be gravity fed and not have to have a large series of lift stations and such? Are we unique, or is this pretty common?
I can probably turn to Angie and Paul, since they work with more communities than I do.
I would say it's a mixture. There's definitely some, you know, a lot of historic cities were built around water features, rivers, so a lot of the area does drain to a particular point, but there's others that have a lot more.
Sure.
But typically a gravity sewer is a lot cheaper to maintain than the cost of a lift station and all the operating costs associated with it. That's why whenever we've had an opportunity, we've gotten rid of a lift station.
Okay, Mr. Wood.
No, that was
okay,
it.
Every time I hear Mitzi talk about the comprehensive plan, it does make me smile because it seems like it's bringing us in a direction that we'll need to go. First quarter 2017 is coming to an end. I think the original target was fourth quarter 2015. I see that you're on the agenda for our session that we're doing as a group in April, but when does the city council, when are we going to have a draft comprehensive plan update in our hands to read?
Wednesday night, Sandy and I will be introducing Section 1 to the Planning Commission.
Okay.
And on Thursday, we're going to post an electronic copy of that draft. I'm going to send you a link.
And what is Section 1?
That's Section 1, Section 2 and 3 need a few more edits before they're brought Section 1 is going to really tell you about the major direction, the vision, and the need for the community.
Okay.
Sections 2 and 3 are more technical and content-heavy. We'll get into a little bit more detail on the how to in the strategies. But those will be forthcoming in the next few weeks.
I like the answer of this week.
Good time to ask a question, then.
And I think we're working on perhaps bringing an update to the Committee of the Whole in mid-April so that we'll be prepared to make good, productive use of our day on 28th, right?
That's right. We're looking at, we've been working with staff to identify a week that will work for us to target some outreach meetings, and we'll be bringing Charlie back to Minnesota for that week, too.
Okay. Dale, or?
I can, in the interest of time, I can ask a question.
Okay, all right. Welcome. Anything else?
Thank you for allowing us the opportunity. And if you have any questions, just
the only other final comment, quick comment I'll make is I like the idea of your last slide of the modeling. And, you know, one of the things I know we've talked about off and on are some regional aspects, particularly Orinoco. And in this case, perhaps the state's appetite to contribute to some of that. So I don't want an answer today, but I would hope that our modeling allows us to play with those sorts of what-if scenarios too.
Basically, it's an input. It's a point source load, and we can put that in, and then we could model the impact of that.
Okay.
So wanted to jump onto two quick things for other business.
Sure.
I want to request an update. We haven't heard anything for many months now on the Skyway downtown. The mayor's taken over those negotiations. I'd like the mayor to give us an update next week.
I just saw a memo last week from Jay Hesley, who said that they had hired a consultant.
Well, they had a team up there.
I'm sorry?
Yeah.
There's a team up there.
Right.
And I just want an update. I don't care if it's here, if it's in writing, but you know, the council direction would have had this settled by early January, and now we're going into April. Second thing is, and I don't think this was necessarily our intent, but looking at the calendar, right now in July we're set to have staff go away for the weekend, come back on a Monday, and then go on have Tuesday off. We still have our meeting scheduled on Monday despite the Tuesday holiday, so I would propose that we would move those July 3rd meetings to July 5th.
Works. Anyone have a complaint with that?
No.
That would be typical. We would align with the council.
I think that was probably just an oversight by our part, and I'll formalize it then tonight under other business. We do post those meetings, so.
All right. Anything else for this afternoon? All right, great. We'll see everyone this evening.